Okay, so we're very lucky today. We have Peter Blexley with us. You might have listened to an earlier episode that we released on the Alistair Wilson murder. Peter investigated the case and spoke with us about that. And now he's actually going to talk to us about another case that he's currently investigating. Peter, I believe you have a really good podcast on BBC Sounds, which Emma and I have both listened to. And this is something that you're quite passionate about at the moment. But first, do you want to just give our listeners a little bit of an intro and just tell them who you are and a bit about your background?
Certainly. Well, for those of you that didn't listen to Emma and Joanna's episode about me talking about the Alistair Wilson case, I asked the question, why not? But there's a rather more lengthy intro about me on that one. But essentially, I'm a former Scotland Yard detective, and I'm now an author and a broadcaster. And it is my life's mission to hunt down a very much wanted fugitive by the name of Kevin Parle, P-A-R-L-E.
Okay. So, as I said before, you've released a podcast about your search for Kevin Parle, which Emma and I have listened to. It's very, very good. I would absolutely recommend it. I have to say, Peter, I listened to it back to back. So I completed it in a few hours. I'd listened to all the episodes. And I was a little bit gutted that it's on a bit of a cliffhanger and that we'll have to wait for more episodes. But still very, very good. And I'll be very keen to pick them back up when there are more released. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about your investigation for Kevin Parle and the accompanying podcast as well?
Certainly. Well, thank you very much for listening to our podcast, which is called Manhunt Finding Kevin Parle. And there's a slight spring in my step today because yesterday that podcast was named as the BBC's number one true crime pod of 2020. And we are also in the BBC's top 10 for all their podcasts this year, which is quite an achievement when you look at the content that they've got out there and some of the absolute juggernauts and extremely famous people that we're up against to have got the number 8 slot in their entire list of pods this year is quite an achievement and is testimony to the wonderful but very small team that I work with. But essentially, the podcast was not the first thing that I had commissioned about my hunt, my ongoing hunt for Kevin Parle. When I left Channel 4's Hunted show in February of 2019, I was thinking, what's going to be my next major project? My publisher said I could write another book if I had the right subject material. And I thought, well, you know, what would be the best use of my skills, my network, experience, and what I'm known for? And of course, what I was known mostly for was hunting pretend fugitives on a blooming TV entertainment show. So having left that, it made sense to combine all of those into hunting for a real fugitive instead of pretend ones on the telly. And they do not come any more wanted than 6'6", Liverpudlian, who's now 40 years old, having been on the run for over 16 years, wanted in connection with two separate murders, Mr. Kevin Thomas Parle. Of course, I've spent nearly 20 months dedicating my life to finding Parle and researching him extensively for not only our BBC podcast, but for a book which I've written, which got published just a couple of months ago and has proved to be very popular. Unashamed plug, the book and the podcast are two very different vehicles. The pod has been hugely successful, over 3 million downloads and counting, and the book has also proved to be very popular with people who have devoured both the pod and the book, which is also called Manhunt, because they're very different vehicles. You know, the book is my first-person narrative of my hunt for Parle, what I've been through, what I am still going through, because I shall simply never give up looking for Kevin Parle. There are only two things that will stop me hunting Kevin Parle. Number one, obviously, is his capture. And number two, quite simply, is my death. I will not stop hunting for Kevin Parr. The two murders that he's wanted for are both ghastly, repulsive crimes. The first one, June 2004, the shooting dead of a 16-year-old boy, a child, a kid, called Liam Kelly. Now, Liam was no model student. But there again, when I was 16, nor was I. Liam was blasted to death with a shotgun in the early hours one Saturday morning after he had been called on to what, in criminal circles, they call a straightener. In other words, a meeting where people straighten things out. But, you know, and I know that through over 20 years as a detective, I know that they very, very rarely end well. And sadly, this ended with Liam's tragic murder. Three people have been convicted in connection with Liam's murder. A man called Anthony Campbell, who was the guy that Liam originally had the dispute with, over 200 quid. Yes, 200 pounds.
That's the bit that got me. That's the thing that I really struggled with. 200 quid to lose a life over. Horrific.
Yeah, just pointless, utterly, utterly pointless. Anthony Campbell was convicted of murder because he called Liam onto the meeting and was clearly aware of what was going to go on. A man called Peter Sinclair got 8 years because he assisted Kevin Parr in burning clothing and destroying of mobile phones and driving him away. And a young lady who very naively thought that she was Kevin Parr's only girlfriend at the time, and believe you me, she wasn't, she, in her rampant naivety, gave a false alibi statement for Kevin Parr, which had absolutely catastrophic consequences because when she'd given her statement, the police were up against a ticking clock in terms of how long they could detain Parr for. And in order to actually bottom that alibi out, they had to grant him bail. And of course, he has never been in a police cell since. And that is over 16 years ago. She also received a short jail term for her utter, utter stupidity. But that was the kind of hypnotic, pervasive influence that Kevin Parr has over people. He's a very bright, smart, intelligent guy. People have repeatedly told us that. And I begrudgingly have, of course, to accept that because he's been successful for the last 16 years. But he will be found. He absolutely will be found. I say that not brimful of confidence, but because I know just how determined I am. And I know how far I've come in nearly 20 months. And I've still got a long way to go, but he will be found.
One of the things that came up when I was listening to the podcast, it was a question I had. I was wondering if you could clarify for me. So I remember in the podcast you were saying that Kevin Parr obviously appeared in court, and then he was released on bail.
No, he didn't appear in court. He was released from police bail. He was released from the cells on police bail.
Right. Well, in the podcast it said, it seemed to indicate something about the defence barrister asked the judge whether there was a case to answer to. And I wondered what that meant.
No, well, let me deal with the second murder now, because that falls under the bracket of the second ghastly, ghastly crime, which was the shooting to death, also with a shotgun, of a young lady who is described to me as being as beautiful on the inside as she was on the outside. A 22-year-old mother of three young children called Lucy Hargreaves. Nobody has a bad word to say about Lucy. Not only was she blasted with a shotgun as she lay on her sofa late one evening, but the house was then doused in petrol and set alight. All the while, her boyfriend, a man called Gary Campbell, and the father of her three children, her long-term partner, was upstairs in bed, somewhat inebriated after a night out, with their two-year-old. The other two young children were with the grandparents. A court was told the following year, 2006, that two men who stood in the dock by the names of Anthony Fat Tony Downs and Kirk Bradley, both charged with Lucy's murder, sat in the dock, and the case was slung out after the prosecution had presented their evidence because the judge said the evidence simply wasn't strong enough. So Downs and Bradley never had to present their defence. Paul, if he hadn't already been on the run for Liam Kelly's murder, I think would have been in the dock as well. Clearly, there were some failings in the police investigation. The presentation of the evidence wasn't perhaps what it should be. And I've spoken to defence barristers, journalists, other people that had a considerable interest in that trial. And Downs and Bradley walked free men, unconvicted. Actually, in fact, they didn't walk out of the court. They virtually danced and skipped their way out of the court. But Downs and Bradley did not then go on to live law-abiding lives, having had one scrape with the criminal justice system. Far from it. They then went on to conduct a campaign of terror across the city of Liverpool with guns and grenades. And later on, when they were arrested, they were charged with that campaign of terror. They then both later escaped from a prison van, taking them to court for their trial. That was ambushed by a gang of criminals who threatened to blow the van driver's head off unless the keys were handed over. Downs and Bradley were sprung and fled abroad, where they were both later captured, brought back to the UK, had to have another trial because they'd been whisked away mid-trial. Another trial was held, this time in London and not in the Northwest for security purposes. And Downs and Bradley both received life imprisonment with a minimum term of 22 years each for the 16 shootings and 4 grenade attacks that they'd been involved in. They, of course, are currently still serving their life sentences. Paul remains wanted for both of those crimes. And the point that you alluded to is, well, would Paul be convicted of Lucy's murder when he gets arrested? Will he, in fact, even be charged with it? We could spend a lot of time discussing that. But quite frankly, that is not my concern. When I started hunting Kevin Paul, I did not set out to investigate the murders. Although, of course, in honour of Liam and Lucy's memory, they are episodes 1 and 2 of Manhunt Finding Kevin Paul. And quite rightly so. They should be front and centre of the story. They are front and centre of what I do. That's why I get out of bed every morning at the crack of dawn and start hunting Kevin Paul until late at night, every day of the week, 7 days a week. Yes, I get some downtime from time to time, but my campaign to raise the profile of Paul and the crimes he's wanted for hoovers up just an inordinate amount of time. But it was my idea. I'm a volunteer. I've got no one to blame and I'm not complaining. It will all be worthwhile when Kevin Paul is in handcuffs.
Can I just, for our listeners, can you just tell us of the first time you remember hearing his name and then where that kind of fascination gripped you and how it's brought you to this point?
Yeah, well, my second and third books were about unsolved murders. My second book, On the Run, was a sort of a compendium of unsolved murders that I went out and researched and investigated. And my third book, To Catch a Killer, is Alistair Wilson, which we discussed when I was last with you. So to a large extent, unsolved murders are something that I have a passion for. And it's my business, if you will. So Kevin Paul was on my radar some years ago. I knew the name. I knew the crimes he was wanted for. But my circumstances were such that I'd never got to the point where I could dedicate my entire life, nor had I had the idea or the inclination or got anything commissioned, you know, because it's important that I earn money along the way, of course, albeit, let me tell you, that in, and this is an update which people from Manhunt, this is an even later update. I can tell you that in the last 20 months, in connection with my hunt for Kevin Pahl, with both the podcast and the book, I have earned £13,000 in 20 months. Okay? Mm. So anybody that wants to tell me I'm making money out of other people's misery better be able to run pretty damn quick. And out of that £13,000, I have not put one carrot on my family's dining table. Not one. Because I have spent weeks and weeks and weeks away from home, of course, in hotels, planes, trains, automobiles. We've been on all of them. Fuel for cars. When you're on the road, every cup of coffee, every Diet Coke, every sandwich, every meal, every occasional bottle of red, all has to be paid for. And it's an expensive business. So I certainly don't do this for the money.
I think it's the same with a lot of independent investigators that are wanting to bring light to certain cases. Often people do think that you're either doing it out of some sort of morbid glory hunt or, for money. And the irony is some of the biggest podcasters and broadcasters that we know break even and aren't living in mansions. And it's the love of it. It's literally a labour of love. So absolutely.
Yeah.
We've been, 8 months doing this podcast. We release weekly, and I think we've made less than £200.
Yeah, because we're not doing it for that reason. It's the sheer enjoyment and the fact that, honestly, we would be reading about all these things anyway, and we'd be talking to each other about them anyway because of what we're interested in and the nature of our relationship with each other. The fact that we can record it and speak to wonderful people like yourselves and share that with other people is just enough, to be honest. However, if you do want to randomly, anyone out there, if you just want to sponsor us for random things, feel free.
As well, though, like for me, we obviously have an interest in unsolved cases as well. And the thing is that every time there's a conversation's had about it, it's in people's minds. Mm. You know, whether they can contribute something or not, you know, they might then talk to the next person about it, who might talk to the next person about it. For me, it's just really that if you're talking about it, then it's not forgotten. You know, it's not lost in the ether. If somebody's having a conversation about it, then to me, that means something.
And honouring the memories of the victims along the way, because for me, everything's about victims. Absolutely. Everything I do, victims are front and centre of my every thought. You know, I've been invited. I was offered a lucrative deal to co-present a co-production, an international podcast series with another host from America, which was going to focus on serial killers. And I just said, no, I'm not doing it. I just completely walked away from it. I'm not in the business of glorifying people who might be sitting in a cell with access to a podcast, gratifying themselves as they hear their name being mentioned repeatedly. I'm not doing it. I'm about victims. I'm not interested in the slightest. For me, it's victims, their loved ones, family, friends, all of that. Then next in line would be the great detectives that solve these cases and giving them credit and coverage and giving their work some coverage. And, you know, killers don't really do it at all. But, of course, there's a slight contradiction here in so much as that I'm hunting Kevin Pahl, but he is unconvicted of both these cases. I am driven by a sense of justice. If things are unjust, then it leaves a very bad taste in the mouth, and it's frustration, and it wrecks people's lives, and it makes the hurt and the suffering even worse. So Kevin Pahl, you know, wanted in connection with both of these ghastly crimes, quite simply needs to stand in a court of law and answer the allegations made against him. I'm not saying he's guilty, not at all. But I do know he's wanted for both of them. He's on the National Crime Agency's most wanted list. So it's not a secret. And he needs to stand in a court of law.
As much as we love to discuss the victims, and obviously we've had a little bit of a chat about some of the crimes that he stands accused of I do think it would be good to have a good understanding of the person himself. So if you would enlighten us a little bit as to who he is, where he comes from, any characteristics. Obviously, his physical characteristics are quite, he's quite a recognisable individual, but more so you were saying that he's really clever, he's really good at pulling the wool over people's eyes. Is that fair to say?
Well, he's a smart, intelligent guy. He's not what you might think is your typical kind of, you know, criminal, shall we say. Forgive me if I'm using sort of broad kind of caricatures almost, but Kevin Powell did not come from Highton, Croxteth, Toxteth, Norwich Green, those kind of areas which has been the birthplace of many, many notorious Liverpool criminals over the years. Kevin Powell lived what I call a very semi-detached life, quite literally. You know, lived in a decent street called Pittville Avenue with his very tall brothers and then later his half-sister, because his mum and father divorced and she remarried and had the daughter. And he went to a fee-paying primary school and then went to Liverpool College, a fee-paying secondary school. And I've been to both of them. You know, Liverpool College is very grand with its rugby pitches and its very kind of proud signage that displays that we are Liverpool College and all of that. So not your typical kind of upbringing that you might have expected for somebody to then get wrapped up in serious and organised crime. And I've had a number of people that have come forward and told me that that is exactly what he did. He was involved in serious and organised crime. All right, I don't have the evidence to prove it, but I suspect that Merseyside Police probably have a bit of a file, and I'll get on to talking about them a bit later on. I was told that he had literally tens upon tens of thousands of pounds laid down in various places when he went on the run. Well, that won't have lasted him very long. He had an ambition to be rich. He wanted to be rich. And at one point, we're talking now around about sort of 2004, the year that Liam was tragically gunned down, he said that he wanted to have a book written about himself. Because a couple of years before that, there was a very, very famous true crime book written called Cocky. And it was all about a notorious Liverpool gangster called Curtis Warren, who was alleged to be like Britain's biggest drug dealer at one point. Curtis Warren is now incarcerated, but he was very, very notorious. And the book Cocky, which is a terrific book, even though it's been published for some 20 years now, I'd recommend anybody with a true crime fascination have a read of it. Peter Walsh, one of the authors, has become a pal of mine. Powell said, you know, he wanted a book written about him. Well, I've ticked the box for him there, okay? One of his ambitions has been met, although I doubt he wanted me to write the book that I have, because Manhunt basically is the longest wanted poster ever written in the history of mankind. And people have said lovely things about it. And please, lay your hands on it and you'll find out so much more about Kevin Powell and my journey in trying to hunt him down.
Yeah. Kevin Powell, if you're out there, just give us your address and we'll send you a signed copy.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll sign it. I won't.
And then there'll be some blue lights following swiftly after. Yes. They might deliver it to you.
Yes, be hand delivered.
I mean, you laugh and you joke, but Kevin Powell and his associates are across all my broadcasting. So somebody will listen to this. Somebody with an interest in Kevin Powell will listen to this. Undoubtedly. Absolutely. Undoubtedly. And so, of course, I have to have a media strategy. You know, I'm posting frequently across social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all as Peter Blexley. You know, I do have a media strategy, albeit I make it up as I go along sometimes. You know, but do I want to irritate them? Those who are harbouring him and funding him? Yes, I do. Do I want to give them sleepless nights? Absolutely, you better believe I do. Because he, quite frankly, and a large part of my motivation for hunting Kevin Parr was that he was such an unknown. I mean, he should be a household name. There's nobody else in the UK wanted for two separate murders. Look at all the wanted lists. There might be somebody wanted for murdering two people on one event, but two separate murders? Nope. Parr's out on his own in that regard. And he should be a household name. And I'm doing my level best to try and make that happen. That's why, you know, it's what the pod, the book, the website, my website, peterblexley.com, where I regularly post updates on there. You know, that's what it's all geared towards.
You were saying about, obviously, the last 20 months of your life have sort of been consumed by just, you know, working your behind off to try and, you know, hunt him down, get his name out there, you know, and like you say, trying to make it a household name and things like that. So, and you were talking about flights and hotels and things as well. So that then, for our listeners who haven't listened to your podcast, leads nicely on to the fact that you've left the country in search of him.
Yeah, we've been to Spain. Yeah, we flew out to Spain earlier this year, of course, before lockdown, and had a very, very interesting few days out there. The standout moment for me, which I think is in episode 8 of the pod, was we'd been told originally that he used a bar called Chill Out in a town called Albia, just outside of Benidorm. Well, we found the Chill Out bar, and to my huge irritation, it was closed, right? I mean, you know, the front doors were chained together with a mighty chain and a padlock, and there was barrier tape, the kind of stuff that you'd find at a crime scene, all across the front of it, and it had been closed for some months. So I was very unhappy that we'd flown all the way out there to discover that. So I then got onto one of my sources, because I've got numerous sources, brave, courageous, public-spirited, wonderful people who want Kevin Parr in handcuffs that have and continue to help me. I got back on the phone to one of my sources who was mortified that Chill Out was shut, absolutely mortified. Not long after that source had made a few phone calls, they went, there might have been some confusion because I'm told that Kevin Parr frequented a cannabis club or a cannabis association, as they're known in Spain and some other countries. And I wasn't overly familiar with these because my, you know, smoking a spliff and eating four boxes of Maltese a day is well behind me, right? So, these cannabis clubs or cannabis associations are places where if you produce some photographic ID and proof of your address and pay a membership fee, which can be anything from like 20 euros to 100 euros, you are allowed to frequent this club, have a drink, and you can smoke your own cannabis. You can't buy it and you can't deal it. And there's pretty strict rules around all of that. But if you want to go there and chill out, get it, hence the possible confusion, you can go there, have a joint with like-minded people. So I'm told that this cannabis association, where Parr has definitely been, I am told, right, is between a gym and a cocktail bar on the N332, I think, from, the major road. So me and my great friend and podcast editor, Mark Sandell, we're out there. We find the cocktail bar, because it literally was called Cocktail Bar, and it was a huge, great sign. After a little bit of poking around, we find the gym, right, and there was loads of kind of like flamenco type sort of music pumping out of this gym. And I had a little peek through the window and there's some ladies doing a Zumba class or something like, I've never seen me move so quick as I got away from the front of that gym. I've seen it up. That's it. Right. So we then locate, well, we're trying to locate this cannabis club. Now, in my head, right, perhaps stupidly and naively, I thought it might be some sort of cave-like bohemian sort of dwelling where people might be wearing Afghan coats and flowing robes and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong if I'd tried. I'm looking at the front of a premises, again, between the cocktail bar and the gym, and to me, it looked like a modern sort of doctor's surgery or a dental practice. You know, that kind of white frosted frontage where you think, you know, they could be able to see out, but you couldn't see in sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right? And all kind of, anyway, I'm just nosing around. And on the door is an A4 piece of paper, which conveniently was translated into English as well, closed for renovations, and a number. You know, well, once a detective, always a detective. So I've taken a photograph of that, right? You never know. I'll check out that number. And no sooner had I done that than me and Mark were taken by surprise as two young men came out of the door of these premises, right? They kind of like had Southern Mediterranean complexions. I couldn't quite detect the accents, but I was thinking Mediterranean. And they were like, "Hi, can we help you?" You know, and I said, "Oh yeah, taken by surprise." Mark fortunately has got his microphone out because he was just about to record my reaction to finding or not finding this cannabis bar. And I said, "Yeah, I'm looking for a bloke called Kevin." And immediately this guy went, "Oh, tall Kevin," because Kevin Powell's 6'6", right? And I've gone, "Yeah." Yeah, he went, he said, and this is where I made one of my many mistakes that I've made while hunting Kevin Powell, and so be it. You know, it is essentially me, my pen, my notebook and my mobile phone against serious and organised crime that are linked on a global scale. So I'm a bit outgunned here, if you know what I mean. Anyway, I still made a dreadful mistake, which I wouldn't have made if I was half my age and half my weight, and still working undercover, you know, at Scotland Yard like I used to. I delved into my rucksack, which is quite simply never very far from me, and I'm reaching out to it now, and I pulled out a flyer. I had flyers printed on day one of my hunt for Kevin Powell, which had "I'm coming for you" emblazoned across the top. That was the working title of my book, which is now, of course, Manhunt. And on it, I've got the pictures of Liam and Lucy, of course, pictures of Kevin Powell, which were developed by a university from his original police mugshot. They'd aged them and all of that. And, of course, these pictures look like what they are. In other words, they've been computer-enhanced from a police mugshot. And like a fool, I've pulled out one of these flyers, shown it to the blokes, at which point they've gone, "Oh, no, that's not our Kevin. Our Kevin we're talking about is much older. He's like 75. Right, and of course, I suddenly realised what a complete idiot I had been. Because what I should have done, because my rucksack is always bulging, particularly when I'm on the road, you know, it's got so much stuff in there. I should have just held up the rucksack when they said, "Why do you want to speak to him?" I should have said, "Because I've got 100,000 euros in here." Right? Now, if I'd said that, it might have been a very, very different thing. But unfortunately, I just proved that I'm kind of gone at the game, and it was far from my most glorious moment, I'm afraid to say.
Do you know what the thing is, though, that it's you were taken completely off guard? So it's not even like you could have pre-planned it, you know, about how to sort of... you know, put the question across, because obviously you thought you were going to phone this number and you probably would have had a bit of a game plan for calling the number based on, you know, who answered and what was said. But probably the fact that they just opened the door and said, "Can we help you?" You know, you're probably a bit like deer in the headlights kind of thing. But I did notice that the exchange was very bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, at first when I was listening, and like you say, and they said, yeah, tall Kevin, because obviously 6'6" is not small, you know, and that's not just like kind of tall, that's standout tall. So as soon as they said that, I thought, wow, like, you know, And then the sudden, you know, wrong person. The sort of backpedaling was very obvious.
Yeah. Thank you. And you know, we've played that clip to far greater minds than mine. You know, Professor David Wilson, who I mentioned on the Alistair Wilson one, you know, a proud Scotsman, brilliant man, and my mate. I played it to him and others. And that formed part of episode 9 of the podcast, yeah. The review. And they all kind of like laughed, you know, because to them, the change of tack was so blatantly obvious that they then started
they clearly know him.
Because they were talking about Kevin Parr.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing is, though, at some point, you were always going to have to show a picture of him to someone, and you were never going to be able to tell if that was going to be the right person or the right time to do it. Do you know what I mean? There was always going to be an interaction at some point.
You're very, very kind, ladies, right? You are very, very kind. But the bottom line is, I'm gone at the game. And like, when I was 30 years old and working undercover, thinking on my feet was my business. It was how I stayed alive. And if I'd been as sharp in Albia as I had been when I was undercover, we'd have a very, very different story to tell now. If I'd lifted up that rucksack and gone, bang, yeah, here's 100 grand for him, it would have been a very different story. I might be dead, of course.
I was going to say, you might be dead,
be dead, but, you know.
They could have grabbed you, kidnapped you, took your bag.
And then been really disappointed at all the flyers.
But what the bloody hell is this? This isn't 100,000 euros or whatever. But yeah, so also, I don't want to give too much away because obviously we do want our listeners to go and listen to your podcast because it is really interesting. And like you say, the book separately, I've not read that yet, but I absolutely plan to. So I don't want to give too much away to our listeners because I really think that they would be interested in listening to your podcast and for sure. So I don't want to give away sort of too many secrets, but there was mention of potential sightings back in Liverpool. I don't know if you want to touch on that at all or talk about that.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I know that Kevin Powell, whilst he's on the run, has been in Spain, Thailand, Dubai, and Ireland. Right? Some people have said he's been in Liverpool, but I'm less inclined to believe those. Right? But Ireland, Dubai, Thailand, Spain, yes, to all those four places. So, as you can imagine, this wretched virus has made life very frustrating for me because I can't get on a plane like I want to and go to those places.
It might make it more frustrating for him also, though.
Oh, he's got all the advantages, right? You know, he doesn't have to abide by the law of the land, does he? You know, he can jump in the back of a lorry and go wherever his connections could take him, you know.
I'm more thinking also for him making money, however he's making it or whoever's funding him. You know, times have changed, times are different. Even there's been stories about some of the, you know, the illegal drugs trade within the UK and the lines of supply for that and how people are struggling to get their supplies and addicts are relapsing, going into centres because the, you know, the drugs, legal drugs trade is in a state as well. So if this guy is operating on solely illegal means, I mean, he's unlikely to be working as an accountant somewhere. what is he doing? Where is he getting his money from?
He is being harboured and funded by people involved in serious criminality of the most serious kind, and some of the more obvious serious and organised crime. That I know. It's just a case of finding.
Do you have any thoughts about whether he will be at a disadvantage as a result of the coronavirus pandemic? Do you think that it could potentially make things more difficult for him in terms of moving around or being spotted or just being restricted? Have you sort of entertained that thought at all? I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Once again, smart, intelligent guy protected by a very tight network. You know, and they have utter disregard for the laws of the land in whatever jurisdiction they're operating. So the advantages are all with him. You know, I'm completely outnumbered. You know, as I say, they would laugh at the fact that I've earned 13 grand in 20 months. You know, they would absolutely laugh at that. So the advantages are all with him. But, of course, it's going to make his capture so much sweeter. So much sweeter when it happens. It will all be worthwhile. And my work then will be done. You know, I'm not part of the prosecuting team. I'm not gathering evidence against the crimes. In fact, I naively said right from the start of my hunt that I'm not investigating other criminality, because I haven't. I'm not really interested in who's serving up who with cocaine or cannabis or guns or all of that. But it's been unavoidable. I have been made privy to a lot of that sort of information during my hunt for him, albeit that's not what I set out to do.
Yeah. So what's your plan of action then when the sort of pandemic is coming to an end and things are starting to move again and we're kind of getting back to some sort of normality? What's your sort of plan of action, if you will? What
I am waving my passport at you, Lena. Okay, that's the plan of action. Not only abroad, but there are many people within the UK that I want to knock on doors and get in front of people. And some of these people are going to be extremely unhappy to see me standing on their front doorsteps, and they might well slam the door. But that, to me, tells a story all of its own. Fortunately, we live in the age of the digital detective or the desktop detective, call it what you will. So my hunt for Parle continues every day, every single day, because there is always something to be done. And so, yeah, you know, lockdown didn't mean slowdown, not in any way, shape or form. I've also been commissioned to write another book on my hunt. So, you know, people have enjoyed Manhunt, and my publisher hasn't set a deadline on it, but just realises that might be a good idea to get me to sign my life away to doing another book, because there's clearly an appetite for people, knowing about this hunt, which has been remarkable. I mean, I've spent so little time with my family, really, in the last 19 months, compared to what I would have done if I were, I don't know, doing many other things. But that's fine. They understand. They get it. They want me to be stimulated and happy and flying out of bed in the morning to do stuff. And that's all fine. And, of course, none of it, well, it all pales into insignificance, doesn't it? Because this is not about me, and it's not really, bizarrely, about Kevin Parle. It's about Liam and Lucy. And imagine the hurt and pain that Lucy's kids, Liam's mum, Liam's friends, Lucy's partner, Gary, you know, imagine the hurt, the pain, the suffering that all those people are still going through. So the fact that I spend a few months away from home and, you know, only cop 13 grand is a bit pathetic in comparison to that.
In the grand scheme of things, it's not that significant. Like you say, when you put the focus on the victims and what you're actually trying to achieve in the bigger picture, it pales a bit insignificance, definitely.
I had a question as well. So we've spoken before about your previous life in the police and how you worked as an undercover operative as such, and integrated yourself into kind of criminal lifestyles and so on and so forth. The only thing that strikes me going through listening to your search and your hunt is the personal danger that you put yourself in. And it just strikes me that must have prepared you for it, because no person in their right mind, honestly, would just kind of throw themselves into this hunt. I mean, it's amazing. You're literally painting a target on your head to this criminal network, and it's absolutely mind-boggling. I'm someone who's quite risk-averse, and I was wondering, are there ways that you protect yourself? Do you think about that, or is that something that you've kind of compartmentalized and you don't think about because it is a little bit scary sometimes?
No, I think about it, but a long time ago, when I was hurriedly parachuted into witness protection because of my work undercover, you know, and my life was very much under threat as discovered by the FBI, and a report was stolen with my real name in it, and that's another lengthy story. I spent 2 years in constant fear of the assassin's bullet, conspiracy theorizing as to how I'd got to this point and looking over my shoulder. And it quite simply made me ill, very, very ill, which is why I got admitted to a lock-in psychiatric ward. After I'd got better, and that was a long slog, and I'm still very mindful of mental health, not only mine, but my friends, my family's, anybody's, you know, we've all got mental health. Sometimes it's robust and great, and other times it can be a bit fragile. So we all have to look after it. I decided a long time ago when I went public with my autobiography that I was not going to live my life looking over my shoulder anymore or ever again. And I vowed that, and I've not broken that vow. I'm not going to live my life looking over my shoulder for Kevin Parr and his cronies, because what's the worst they can do? Put a bullet in my head. Well, I've lived 61 largely very good years on this planet. You know, my three kids are all now literally just in adulthood, you know, 18, 19 and 32. What's the worst they can do? Kill me. So what?
Yeah.
They'll bring an awful lot of very stupid attention upon themselves if they gun me down in the street or try and crash through my front door, which is like Fort Knox. You know, I don't have a letterbox. You know, I've got state-of-the-art CCTV and a burglar alarm and all that kind of thing, which you'd probably expect from the sort of life I've lived. But, you know, I'm not going to live my life looking over my shoulder. Kevin Parr and your cronies, do your worst, right? Because I ain't ever stopping. I simply am not stopping. And they've done their bits and pieces. There's been pictures of my house posted on social media platforms. On one occasion, they posted a picture of my house with an accurate description of the bedroom that I sleep in. So clearly some people with his best interests at heart are not very far away from me. But you know what? Bring it on. If that's the best you've got, then you're pathetic. You know, and these people are not going to throw a can of paint over my car, are they? They're not going to daub a wall in full sight of my CCTV. If they're going to do anything, they're going to put a bullet in the back of me. Well, I ain't going to worry about that. They're more worried about me than I am worried about them. Of that, I can guarantee you.
Love it. Perfect answer.
Absolutely. And probably a very, very good note to end on. So, yeah, if you want to just recap for us, if you could just remind our listeners the name of your book and the name of the podcast so they can go and have a listen, because I'm sure they'll be interested to read more about it and hear more about it.
Thank you. Well, my book, which is called Manhunt, is available at the ludicrously inexpensive price of £4 on Amazon and theworks.co.uk and all of that, or order it through your local independent bookshop would be lovely. Our number one true crime BBC podcast of 2020 is called Manhunt, Finding Kevin Parr. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much for speaking with us today.
It has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us and hear about all the work you're doing. So, yeah, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you both very much indeed.